From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Go online and it won't take long to find a critic. There are bloggers and tweeters and Yelp foodies everywhere taking a position or a pot shot. A.O. Scott, a chief film critic for the New York Times, says it's the lingua franca of the digital culture. And with so much criticism everywhere you look, it seems like there's the possibility it will stop meaning anything. And Scott wondered about that, wondered about the future of his job in such a culture. So he started writing a book about that, but it turned into something else. It turned into an examination of why we like the things we do and how we have discussions about taste and aesthetics. His book is asking, what's the point of criticism? What are critics good for? Today in the program, A.L. Scott will join us to talk about that. We invite you to join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A.O. Scott, a chief film critic for the New York Times, says criticism is an impossible undertaking. He'll explain what he means here in a moment, but he also says in his new book that it's impossible to keep criticism from happening. It's what we do. We judge, we find fault, or bestow praise. And Scott is interested in that tendency, that general tendency, how we know or think we know what's good or what's bad, how we assess success or failure. Criticism, he says, is not just fault-finding or empty praise. It's not just an expression of personal taste. It's not science, not philosophy. It's something else. In his book, he examines how it works, the basis for it, and whether criticism can be more than just useful but helpful. The title gives you a sense of his conclusion. It's called Better Living Through Criticism: How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. And today in the program, A.L. Scott is joining us to talk about it. He's been a critic for the New York Times since 2000. He also writes often for the Times Magazine and the newspaper's Book Review. He has contributed works of critical journalism to Newsday, to Slate, the New York Review of Books, many other publications. He's joining us today from a studio at the offices of the New York Times. And A.L. Scott, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's so nice to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess we need to begin with what I take as the sort of the moment when you really started thinking about this, and that's Samuel L. Jackson, the actor, because he said a few things back in 2012 that really seems to have gotten you thinking about all of this. Set that up for us, if you would, because you wrote a review of the Avengers, and he wasn't crazy about it.
Right. I wrote, as I do, a review of the Avengers that wasn't, I didn't think, an especially hostile or dismissive review. I pointed out a lot of the things that I enjoyed about the movie, some of the performances. There was a kind of a lightness of tone and a bantering mood among the different characters and actors that I quite enjoyed. But I also felt like it suffered from the kind of blockbuster disease where it had to kind of suppress in a way some of its own originality in order to conform to the imperative to be just like all the other superhero movies and give the same big action sequences and teasers for the next sequels and everything else that these movies are supposed to do. So I kind of complained about that. I said it was, a charming little dialogue comedy dressed up as a giant ATM for Marvel Studios and Walt Disney.
And you were about 4 years ahead of the current thinking on that. It seems like you were way ahead of it.
Well, that's what I feel. I do feel in retrospect that I've been vindicated a little bit because by the time Age of Ultron came along, everybody was saying that. Everybody was saying, yeah, there's some fun stuff in there. Sure, Robert Downey Jr., Samuel L. Jackson, Jeremy Renner, whatever. But, oh, God, another one of these big Marvel, blow up the world, have a big fight flying through the air kind of movies. So, but I was a little premature in that judgment, I guess. People still wanted to get excited about these movies and about that. It was not by any means the first in the franchise, but it was the first that was called The Avengers that had been set up with all these teasers in the Iron Man movies and so on.
Yeah.
So Samuel L. Jackson, somewhat to my surprise, because it doesn't usually happen that people who are involved with the movies that I write about, especially the big Hollywood blockbuster movies, say anything, even acknowledge my existence in any way. It's much easier, and they're used to kind of letting it go. But he went on Twitter and he said, Avengers fans, A.O. Scott needs a new job. Let's help him find one he can actually do.
Right.
And he didn't, I guess you would say, he kind of subtweeted me in that he used my name rather than the @, you know, rather than my mm-hmm. handle. So I hadn't seen his original tweet. Instead, I went on Twitter and saw all of these people I didn't know with, like, you know, superhero avatars or whatever, calling me all kinds of names and giving me all kinds of suggestions about what I might actually do.
Right.
But it did get me thinking. So this became a little kind of tempest in a teapot. It sort of blew up all over Twitter, as these things do, because it's, you know, it's a fight. There's a movie star and a movie critic battling. But it did kind of get me thinking, well, what is the job? How do you actually do it? What is it good for? I mean, there was an implication not only in Jackson's tweet, but in a lot of what critics tend to hear from, say, fans of movies that we've panned, that not only are we doing it wrong in some specific instance, but the whole enterprise is kind of pointless and obnoxious, and we should all just go away. And this coincided with a moment, I think, in the history of digital media, let's say, when it looked like and was frequently being said that we were going to all go away, that professional criticism was in its death throes, and that we were you know, going the way of the dinosaurs.
Early on in the book, you say that you thought the answers to these questions, you know, what is the job, how do you do it, would come more easily than they did. So what surprised you about that? What did you think you'd find? I mean, it seems like this idea of taste is, there's a sort of biological component, or it's hormonal, right, or there's some universal standard out there, but it seems like you didn't really find that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I kind of thought, I mean, what should have clued me in a little bit, because I was looking around and I was saying, huh, no one has written a kind of a thorough, full defense and explanation of criticism. And I thought, well, why not? I might as well do it. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. I have thought about it. I've read, you know, many of the great critics of the past, and I'm acquainted with some of the theories of taste and beauty and so on. So it shouldn't be that hard to kind of to put it all together into a nice package. And what I very quickly found was that when you just start to answer or start to inquire about how to answer what seem to be the simplest and most basic questions, those actually turn out to be the hardest and some of the most intractable questions in all of human thought. Just how do we know something is good? What does it mean when we say I like something? How are you even asking the question? Are you asking the question on the level of a kind of a physiological or biological or neurological response that made me feel a certain way, that made my neurons and synapses fire a certain way? It gave me a certain feeling in the pit of my stomach. It made me cry. Or are you talking about something that has to do with the film or the book or the work of art itself, that it has some properties in it that make it special or valuable or wonderful or beautiful? And these questions have been asked over and over again and in a way never satisfactorily answered. I mean, philosophy just kind of bats them around from one side of the net to the next. So I kind of proceeded in this inquiry thinking, okay, maybe I can't ask these questions in a kind of in a full philosophical sense. I'm not going to be able to solve. I'm not a trained philosopher. I'm not even a trained film critic. I'm not going to be able to solve the question of subjectivity versus objectivity or any of these other problems that have bedeviled Western thought since the Greeks. But maybe I can describe what it's like. Yeah. Maybe I can describe some of the process that gets us from feeling something, going mm-hmm. to the movies and feeling awe or boredom or delight or whatever else we feel, and the ways that we have of talking about it, and the ways that we individually and then collectively as a society or as a culture work out these questions of what does this mean? What is this worth? Why is this one better than that one?
It was a couple of months after Jackson went after you on Twitter that he sort of doubles down a bit. He's talking to the Huffington Post. And he says something I wanted to ask you about because you write about this in the book. He says he's just bugged that you're taking this superhero movie and intellectualizing it, is how he puts it. It's not an intellectual exposition, he says, that you have to intellectualize in any way. And he also says this. He says, if you say that something – I'll try to make this public radio friendly. If you say something that's effed up about a piece of BS pop culture that's really good, The Avengers is a effing great movie – Joss Whedon did an awesome job. If you don't get it, then just say, I don't get it. And your response to that is, but wait, I do get it. So what is he saying there when he says, look, don't intellectualize it. It's just a superhero movie. And that's interesting.
Well, it's kind of – he's sort of saying two different things. Why I really like this interview and used it in the introductory section of the book is that it says at the same time, in a way, almost in the same breath, two sort of contradictory things that are nonetheless part of every other – part, you know, are the basis of the argument against criticism, against the legitimacy of critical thought. One of them is, you know, this is right. This is just great. This is an effing great movie. Just like leave it alone. It's so good that nothing you can say is gonna improve it. And in fact, it will have the opposite effect. And just let it be. And if you don't get it, if you have some problems with it, or if it's not working for you, just walk away from it. And let the people who do get it. Enjoy it. And the other one, which I think is equally telling, and in a way I find more disturbing, is the idea that, well, this is just a throwaway piece of pop culture. This is just some junk. You know, this is just like a fast food hamburger. You're going to consume it. You're going to throw away the wrapper. You're going to move on. Why would you think about this? What is to be gained from as he says, intellectualizing it, from trying to take it apart and see how it works, think about what it means, think about what it's doing there. And I have my answer to that partly is that, well, I sort of think if someone is spending $200 million to make something, that doesn't seem like a trivial undertaking to me.
Right.
And if hundreds of millions of people are being asked to have this experience, it seems to be cheapening that experience to say that it's just trivial. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have to be thought about. And in a way, what he's saying there goes back to a lot of the ways that movies and other forms of popular culture have been dismissed kind of by highbrow intellectuals in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, before movie critics came along to defend the artistry of movies, they were thought to be kind of, you know, disposable junk for the masses. It took critics really to discover and to make the case for movies as an art form. Mm-hmm. And I think that any art form, popular or not, deserves to be taken seriously, deserves to be thought about, partly because that movie and other movies, including big blockbuster movies, often do invite us to think. They invite us – comic book movies invite us to think very often about good and evil, about the difference between justice and revenge, about loyalty and friendship and betrayal. All of these things come up often in very powerful and also sometimes very complex and sophisticated ways in these movies. So that seems to me worth some intellectual exposition, let's say.
One of the things that you respond to is this idea, which seems to be this sort of general sense that a lot of us have about criticism, that it's a reactive thing, that it's a secondary activity, as you put it. It's parasitic. And it's I have to say, it's a really interesting part of the book where you write about the writer George Steiner, who is imagining a world without criticism. And it's this kind of utopian world where you don't need criticism. Art just stands alone. And I wanted to have you talk a little bit about that, because you say that for art to thrive, you know, that's his idea. Steiner's saying for art to thrive, criticism has to die. But you say the opposite, in fact, is true. It's a big theme in your book. Would you talk about that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a persistent fantasy, and it connects in a way George Steiner with Samuel L. Jackson, and also with Susan Sontag's very controversial and influential essay Against Interpretation, where she's sort of saying the same thing. Just stop.
Yeah, leave it alone.
All of this chatter, all of this argument, all of this secondary parasitic discourse, it's destroying the host body of art, and we need to just have a direct, unmediated, pure and authentic relationship with works of art. And my counterclaim, the counterargument is, first of all, that's impossible.
Right.
You know, that we're we have, for better or for worse, evolved as these cognitive beings that think and that reflect on what we're thinking and that try to make sense of the experiences we have. But that furthermore, the way that we recognize art, the way that we articulate its power to ourselves is criticism. It's not always formal, published, written criticism. Professional critics have not existed throughout the history of all the arts.
Yeah.
But I do make the argument, and I take it seriously, that criticism, meaning that interpretive, evaluative activity, that way of assigning value and finding meaning within objects that human beings have themselves created, is part of art, is the lifeblood, in a way, of artistic creation, and that the creative impulse and the critical impulse can't be separated. They're really conjoined. They draw from the same source, and that source, finally, you know, in the deepest sense, is our desire to make sense of the world that we live in, and to make sense of our own place within it and our abilities to shape it and represent it and reflect it.
Mm. There's at the heart of the argument at the heart of the fantasy, I guess, if you do away with, we could find some utopia that has no critics in it, is a kind of a distinction that an artist is different from a critic. But as you just said, you say criticism kind of organically evolved alongside of art. One needs the other.
Yes.
And also the point, which is really interesting, you say this, that all art is successful criticism. Rockers and directors and poets, they're critics first.
Yeah, well, that it's not just that criticism kind of exists alongside art, but it's internal to it in a way. I mean, if you look at the history of art, it's artists are reacting to other work, to previous work in the disciplines that they're interested in, to the work that surrounds them. They're in competition with each other. They're trying to imitate or to improve on, or to correct or to overthrow the great works of the past. You see this everywhere. I mean, you can see it very clearly, you know, in the history of European painting, let's say. You can certainly see it in the history of film, with filmmakers like Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino or Truffaut and Godard before them, who are taking previous works and trying to express themselves by not just by kind of imitating or slavishly copying them, but to figure out how they work and how to and make something for and by themselves that will be original, but that comes through their contact with these other artworks. And that's true in the history of literature and popular music. So I wanted to point out that this kind of critical thought is part of what artists themselves are always doing, that this opposition that we often imagine between the artist making something and the critic judging it, which is an often antagonistic, although sometimes supportive relationship, is just one version of the relationship between art and criticism. And another version lives inside of art itself.
You refer to H.L. Mencken in the book. And this was interesting. He said that criticism seems like is what he's saying is criticism is adversarial. It kind of has to be. And because it's personal, like once a critic stops being just a, you know, just a reviewer, once they bring in new ideas, once they have an interpretation on that, that's when you really start pissing off the artist. And I guess that's when it's genuine criticism. That's when the critic starts to lose friends, Mencken said.
Yeah, because it's antagonistic, you know, in the sense that you are holding something up to what can be a very tough or demanding judgment. Yeah. But also in Mencken's account, you're kind of also in competition with the artist because you're making something of your own. He has a very strong. He says in that same wonderful essay, which is called The Critical Process, he says the motives of the critic are not the motives of a pedagogue or a philosopher or a politician or a pundit, but of an artist. You have an idea, you have a feeling, and you want to put it out into the world and make something out of it. And he says the only real difference is that your material that you're drawing on and your inspiration is the work of other artists. And this makes it antagonistic. I think that artists very often see that and object to that. It's like, well, you're putting all of this stuff in there that I didn't say, you know, you're imposing your own meaning on the thing that I made. And that kind of reminds me of something that Oscar Wilde, who's another important figure in this book, said, which is the most profound form of criticism is that which puts something into the work of art that the artist had not put there himself. So there is something to the idea that critics are messing with things. I mean, not just sort of, you know, celebrating or condemning them, but kind of getting into works of art and trying to change them in a way. And I think that's sometimes true. I think that it's often the case with me as a reader of criticism that a record will sound different after I've read what an especially interesting or persuasive critic has to say about it, or a movie I'll go back and see and it will be, you know, colored by the personality of a critic that I've read on it.
A.O. Scott is with us, a chief film critic for the New York Times. His new book is Better Living Through Criticism: How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us A.O. Scott talking about his new book, Better Living Through Criticism: How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. He's joining us from a studio in the offices of the New York Times. He's a chief film critic, of course, for the Times. So you deal with this question, how is it that art and criticism, how do they come about? That is, you know, what function did they serve, for example, for our ancestors? How did they survive, I guess, in human species? Did you come up with – I mean, we were talking about this sort of earlier. Is there any kind of evolutionary or biological advantage to, you know, the creation of art or the assessment of art? Did you find anything?
I didn't find anything. I mean, I'm not deeply read in evolutionary psychology or neuroscience. I know there have been attempts to sort of to figure, you know, to locate the places in the brain where it happens, you know, where we like things. But I could not find a convincing account of where this comes from, you know, because if you think in the sort of the very basic reductive Darwinian account of things, you know, there are two or maybe three imperatives: the protection from danger, you know, finding food to eat, and reproducing the species. Right. And artistic creation and critical judgment is sort of tangled up in those things. I mean, there are ideas, I think, that artistic represent, you know, that paintings on the walls were thought to have some kind of maybe magical effect. You know, that if you drew the beasts, you could acquire some of their power, and you know, they would bring you good luck on the hunt or protect you from the mammoths or whatever. Nobody really knows.
Right.
But I think it's true that the minute somebody drew those figures on the wall, someone else came along and said, well, you know, I mean, the horns are nice, but the way that hoof looks, it's not quite there.
Yeah.
So what the evolutionary purpose of that was, we don't, you know, is sort of lost to history, and I'm just kind of, you know, making this up. But it is fascinating to me how what we think of as aesthetic pleasure, as the sort of the feeling we have when we look at something that's beautiful or moving or intriguing, that's a work of art, how it is in some ways similar to sexual desire, but it's also not the same. I mean, there's a funny way where art, and I don't only mean, you know, paintings of nudes and art that has some kind of overt erotic dimension, but what we feel about works of art is close to other sort of biological urges and feelings, but it's also not the same. It also, because it also activates our brain and our kind of reflective capacities. So it's a very complicated thing. This is what I meant a little bit when we were talking earlier about how daunting and complicated this book turned out to be
right.
to write. Because I was thinking, well, you know, okay, I'm looking at this painting and I think, wow, this is beautiful. What's happening?
Yeah.
What's happening to me? Where did that come from? And that is a tremendously difficult question to ask. So what I did, since as I said, I'm not a philosopher, I'm actually a critic, I tried to find certain works that allowed me to give examples of what might be going on.
And I want to get to some of those. But let's talk about Immanuel Kant, because I think his writing, this section in the book was so extraordinary. So it's kind of the theoretical starting point for criticism. So Kant is talking about, you know, he says, taste is not an intellectual judgment. It's not logical. It's aesthetic. It's subjective. But he also had this idea that everyone kind of deep inside, we all agree about the nature of beauty. And this brings up this idea of subjective universality. Edmund Burke wrote about it. Kant wrote about it.
Yeah.
Would you talk about this idea that somehow, somewhere embedded inside us, we all agree on this idea of beauty?
It's fascinating because this was the big idea in the 18th century, in 18th century European aesthetics. It's what links Burke in Britain and Kant in Germany. This idea that there are some intrinsic identifiable properties of a thing. There is a quantity or an aspect of something that you can call beauty that exists universally, that everybody will agree on, and Kant calls that the subjective universal. So we all have these private individual feelings of delight or disgust or whatever, but what they are responding to are kind of fixed and identifiable quantities out there in the world. And I think this is an idea that has subsequently been overthrown. I think this was an idea that seemed self-evident in the 18th century and that would seem now, let's say in 21st century America, to be undemocratic, to be elitist, to be in no way in any sense politically correct. Because how could you say that everybody, and also just to be empirically nonsensical? How can you say that? You know, my friends and I all like this, you know, and your friends and you all like something else, and how can you say? How could you even find the one?
Right.
The one quality that all of this has in common to say that we're all feeling the same way or looking at the same thing. So very quickly, the idea of of cultural and individual and social differences starts to complicate that idea of the subjective universal.
Yeah. There's an illustration you mentioned in the book. This is the 2010 art exhibit, The Artist is Present. This was at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, Marina Abramović. One of the questions that come up – would you just set this up for us? Because one of the questions that comes up is basically it's just this artist, and she's this renowned artist. She's just sitting there, and people are standing in line. People are going crazy to stand in line and just be in her presence. Would you talk about this? Because I think it's a really great illustration of one thing, you know, that question of you call that art. How can that be art?
Right, right. Well, I mean, it was a fascinating thing. It was a big event. There was a retrospective of Marina Abramović's work, and she's fairly well. She's certainly at least for an artist in the present day, something of a celebrity.
Yeah.
She's been kind of taken up by the fashion world and a little bit by the world of hip hop and popular music. She's in a Jay-Z video, but she'd started out in the 70s doing this form of conceptual art that was very performance based, that didn't necessarily the kind of art that would be, you know, something would happen and it would either be videotaped or written about, but the event itself, the happening, although that's not what she called them, was the work of art.
Right.
And so at this retrospective at MoMA, there were a lot of people reenacting some of the art that she had made in the past, some of the performances that she and other people had done with their bodies sort of choreographed in different ways. So there were like naked people standing around in the galleries in different poses as if they were sculptured, but they were actually people. And that kind of titillated the evening news a little bit, you know, as often happens. There are naked people on 53rd Street. Imagine, you know, that aren't made of marble or bronze or paint. But the centerpiece was this new work called The Artist is Present, where she would sit for the entire duration of the time that the museum was open in a plain chair, and people would come one by one and sit across from her and just kind of look at her, and she would look at them. And it became this kind of sensation, you know, something like 750,000 people did this in the course of its run. And there were lines around the block. And what was interesting to me is that people would have these very powerful emotional responses. People would sit there and they would start to cry. They would be moved in these ways that are very close to the ways that we think about being moved by, you know, by a great aria in an opera, or by a, I mean, that are the most classical responses, the most classic responses to great art. And yet there was no work of art there. There was just this person who none of these people had ever met before. She didn't say anything to them. She didn't do anything. She just kind of looked at them, and she was still. And somehow this set off this, in many, many people, this great tremor. So they'd had some real experience, and I thought that was a great example to talk about, because there are precisely no formal properties that you can identify there, right? That there isn't something you can say, oh well, it's because of you know the harmony in this musical passage, or the composition of this painting, or the contours of this sculpture that are making this happen. There's nothing like that you can identify. There's nothing formal that you can identify that's making it happen, and yet it's happening. And so I thought, well, maybe this is a kind of a good test case for what is happening in all those other examples, where you feel and if you think about it, this is something that you often feel in different kinds of art. Not only that you are recognizing something interesting or profound or human in what you're looking at, but that it's somehow recognizing you.
Yeah.
You know, you can hear a song, or you can see a movie, or you can read a novel, and you can feel this weird sense that it knows something about you. And I think that was part of what people were experiencing. And I think that's part of the power of art, is not only to show us something new, to take us out of ourselves, but also to recall us to ourselves in a new and sometimes very powerfully transformed way.
I really like these dialogues that you have throughout the book, where you're having this funny, really sometimes critical conversation with someone, yourself probably. But there's a section called self-criticism. It's kind of personal, and you reveal your own sort of sense of things, which I really liked. And I wanted to ask you about this, because one of the things you say is that above all, what we crave, what I crave, you say, is expanded consciousness. And this idea of traveling beyond your literal and immediate circumstances can seem trivial or irresponsible, but it's a kind of knowledge for you. And would you just talk about this section? Because it seems like you really kind of got at your own sort of personal sense of all of this.
I do. I mean, the dialogue sections as a whole are kind of there. I put them in a way to because as we've been talking about, as listeners can probably tell, parts of the book are quite dense and abstract and full of some fairly chewy ideas. And the book is not especially personal in most of its sections. Yeah. But I wanted parts of it to be more conversational, more easygoing, more accessible, and also to give me a chance to, without venturing too far into memoir or confession, to reflect a little bit on my own experience and my own self. And so the section you're talking about does talk about my own formative cultural experiences, and also just identifies me as the person I am, you know, as a person born in the 1960s who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you know, a member of the endlessly self-pitying Generation X,
right. In the throes of middle age.
Entering the throes of middle age, yeah. and feeling a little creaky and a little cranky sometimes, but that is the person who wrote this book. You know, it was not written by a disembodied critical consciousness, and no criticism ever is. It was partly also wrote this section of the book to say, look, you know, we're all talking about all this stuff all the time, and we can go, you know, look at paintings in museums and watch television and listen to music and read books and all of this wonderful stuff, but we're also all of us situated people. We have our personal histories. We have the facts of our background, of our religion, of our race, of our class, of our gender, of our sexuality. All of these things are part of who we are, and we're bringing them to the table. But I also wanted to say we don't have to be too narrowly limited by them. We can find out more about the world. And what I wanted to convey, as you were suggesting, is that for me, I've always found literature and film in particular, but other art forms as well, to be tremendously educational, to give me access to experiences that are not mine or that are nothing like mine. And that I still find, you know, as a one of the great pleasures of my job as a film critic is that I get to see and have to write about movies that come from all over the world, from places that I've never been to and that I will probably never go. And they, if they're well made and they kind of tell their stories with the kind of wonderful clarity that film is capable of, it's not that I'm an expert on, you know, life in a Chinese village or in, you know, the kind of the manners and morals of modern South Korea. But I know something about those places and about how people live in them, and about what I might and might not have in common with those people that I don't think I could get from any other source, including sometimes from going to the place myself and just, you know, going to the tourist spots and right. kind of staying in the hotel and then flying home.
Right. A.O. Scott is with us. His book is Better Living Through Criticism, How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with A.O. Scott. We're talking about his book, Better Living Through Criticism. He's joining us from the offices of the New York Times. He's a chief film critic for the Times. So I hadn't realized this, though. It makes sense. You say Amazon could be the largest retail supplier of criticism in the world, which, of course, makes your point that as we all know, critics are pretty much everywhere. But you also write about Henry James, who is taking note of his own time and seems to have a sense that – I guess it made me think that he was sort of griping about it too, that criticism was everywhere and what's going to happen to it. So I guess this is you mentioned the prospect of extinction, that it's perpetually going extinct, I guess, the idea of criticism. This is nothing new, I suppose.
It's perpetually going extinct, and yet there's perpetually more of it than anyone needs or knows what
right.
to do with. This is the paradox. I mean, in a way, it's the paradox of the present moment with the internet, where, you know, critics like me feel like we're under attack and we're all going to lose our jobs, and I could, you know, go upstairs to the culture department right after I stop talking with you, and my editor will say, well, sorry, you know,
it
was
over.
A good run,
yeah.
but we got to chase the page views some other way, and yet at the same time I could you know, pick up my phone and go to Yelp and go to Amazon and go to Twitter and go to Facebook and find, you know, all kinds of opinion on everything. I could find, you know, as much as I ever – more than I could ever read or want to read about, you know, a new restaurant in Manhattan or Hamilton or the new season of Girls or Broad City or whatever else is out there. And I was grappling with this in the early stages of writing the book, because I was trying to figure out, well, what, you know, are the questions, what do critics do and what is criticism, two different questions?
Yeah.
Is there a way maybe also of kind of calming down this antagonism between the professionals and the amateurs? And
yeah.
one thing that I discovered was that this isn't anything new, that what we identify sometimes as, you know, the big crisis or the wonderful glory of the internet has been around at least since the beginning of print. So going back even before James to the 18th century, you could hear people in positions of cultural authority kind of anxiously talking about, well, what are all of these newspapers and pamphlets and who are these people writing, you know, often these anonymous opinions that they have no credentials, they have no, you know, what's going on. And James is writing about the same thing in the 19th century about the periodical press, and he's saying, like, what is going on here? You have these magazines that they have to fill up every month.
Yeah.
So they'll just put a bunch of stuff in it. And if some of it might be great, some of it might be junk, but they have to fill up the magazine and ship it off to the printers every week or every month. And you have a similar thing now where you know, there has to be content. There has to be as much content as possible. And there often doesn't seem to be very much discrimination or judgment about you know, what is the worthwhile and what is the junk. So we've kind of – what I wanted to say was we've always been here. This is
yeah.
kind of where we are. There's always too much of it. There are too many opinions. There's too much noise. We want to just sort of quiet it all down and concentrate on what matters and what's valuable. And that is sort of the struggle of criticism itself and
yeah.
and the function of critics to help guide us through it and to help us find the critical voices, but also the creative work that's worth our attention, that
yeah.
can reward our attention.
Well, critics, you say, help sort through the glut. And this age, all the content and all this movement, it cries out for criticism. I guess this gets to the better living part. I mean, this is the part
yes.
where critics can be useful, helpful.
I think so. I mean, I do feel like it's more necessary than ever, precisely because we live in this time of just extraordinary, often overwhelming abundance. You know, where you can kind of look at your. At your Netflix queue or your DVR or you know, the stack of books that you've bought and haven't read or all of these other things that are clamoring for your attention and making you feel guilty, and you know, you go to work and everyone is saying, you know, did you see that episode, did you read this, what about this, you know, people walk around the streets of Manhattan in despair that they're never going to get to see Hamilton, which everyone is talking about now, but meanwhile there are 40 other places that you could see.
Yeah.
So it, I mean, in some ways it's wonderful right? There's just so much there that is being made to delight us and provoke us and challenge us, and a lot of it is really good. As has always been the case since the beginning of time, most of it is probably mediocre. But we need some kind of way of navigating through it. And one of the things that I try to suggest is that it just the marketing algorithms are not enough. The Netflix queue, you know, saying people who watch this movie also like this movie is not enough. We need to think, and we might need some people to think along with. And so I think of critics as, you know, not necessarily authoritative, directive shamans or priests or guides, but as companions, you know, as kind of attentive and thoughtful companions through this crowded forest of modern culture, helping us figure out what kind of trees we're looking at.
I want to finally ask you about the Pixar film Ratatouille, because it's a lovely section in the book where you write about this. And as I think most people will remember, it was a film about a rat cooking in a fine French restaurant, and there was a. Of course, the Anton Ego, the critic, who's in some ways, like, you get a sense that he might be the villain, but he doesn't really turn out to be. I mean, and I wanted to ask you about this because it seems like you sort of connect in some way to Ego. He has this kind of, as you put it in the book, this kind of lonely vocation, devoting themselves to, here's how you put it, this intense appreciation of something that everyone else either takes for granted or enjoys in a casual, undisciplined way. Would you talk about that? Because I think that your connection to this moment is really terrific, I think.
Well, I mean, I love this movie. And in a way, it kind of takes us back to what we were talking about earlier with Samuel L. Jackson saying, you know, why bother thinking about this thing? And you know, because movies are something that like food, everybody consumes. Everybody goes to the movies. Everybody, you don't need any special knowledge or even any particular interests. And so to be devoted to the highest standards of the art form, to know what it could be, and feel some disappointment when it doesn't live up to that potential can be lonely and can put you at odds with people, as in the movie, who are just going to the restaurant because they want to have a good time. They heard it's good. They're in Paris. You know, they want to eat this food. And he knows that this food is not as good as it could be. He knows that the true villain of the movie, Skinner, the bad chef, has corrupted the great art of gastronomy. And Anton Ego is this feared and often resented critic who is the kind of the fantasy of the critic who can, with a stroke of the pen, you know, shut down a restaurant or close a show or whatever it is. But in fact, he is devoted to this art form, and in that sense, he is not the enemy of Remy the rat, who is the artist figure in the movie, but the only one who really understands him, because he's the one who shares his ideals. So, you know, Remy in an earlier scene is trying to show his brother that you don't have to just like stuff your face with whatever's there, but you can appreciate the flavors and the textures and the different ways things work together, and that there is art and there is appreciation and therefore criticism involved in this most basic activity. And the other person in the movie who knows that is Anton Ego, the critic. And he's the one who's able to recognize what Remy has done and to tell the world about it, which of course turns out to be disastrous for him because not...
Of course.
I don't think I can spoil a movie that's been out for 10 years.
I don't think you can. I think you
He gives a rave review to what Remy has cooked you know, it is the health department discovers that basically vermin have been running the kitchen. they shut down the restaurant, and the critic, who has been saying that this is, you know, this is the greatest restaurant to open in Paris, this is the greatest cook to arrive in Paris in memory, is fired from his job at the newspaper. Yeah. But I like that too. I like the idea that you could and should, in service to these ideals and to the integrity of your own ideas about art, be able to risk everything, to risk being catastrophically wrong.
And what you say too, I liked this as a sort of summing up of some of the themes in the book. What people need, you say, is recognition from a like-minded soul.
Yes, and I think that is very important. And I think that when I have sometimes heard from filmmakers who I've written about, and you know who have nicer things to say maybe than that I need to find a new job, is that, well, it's the flip side of what Samuel L. Jackson was saying wouldn't happen. They to say, you know, you got it, you understood something of what I was trying to do. And and for me, the most satisfying things that I write are when I feel that way, when I really feel like, okay, there's something going on in this film that I feel like I have articulated in a way that it can enhance the audience's experience of it, and also kind of send a message to the artist that whatever she or he was doing, that somebody saw it. Because, you know, being an artist can be a very lonely and alienated condition as well. And you know, you need maybe some friends, some companions. And critics, I think, because our job is to be honest, can be that kind of friend. That is, our praise, you know, when it comes, has to be authentic. It's not just like, you know, your friend or your mom saying, "Hey, great job." it's somebody who doesn't know you personally, nonetheless recognizing something that you did.
A.L. Scott, his book is Better Living Through Criticism: How to Think About Art, Pleasure, Beauty, and Truth. Joined us from a studio at the offices of the New York Times. Thanks very much for the time.
It was a great pleasure, Doug. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.